Good afternoon. This is Division 7 of the Court of Appeals. To my left is Judge Miller. To my right is Judge Jones, in case you're having any trouble pronouncing their names on the placards. My name is Gilbert Roman, and we'll be taking two cases this afternoon. The 130 case will be Hayman Contractors versus the City of Louisville. Are both parties here and ready to go? Very good. And the second case, 2 o'clock, is Martinez versus the Colorado Department of Human Services. And are both parties ready to go in that case? Very good. Bailiff, did you give the instructions to the attorneys as they came in? Very good. All right, so then I'll presume that you've read those. If you have any questions, this would be a good time to ask them now. But otherwise, I think we have experienced counsel, and you know what the time limits are. And the only thing I would ask then is for everyone in the courtroom, if you brought a cell phone or anything else that may go off, or a pager, to please turn it off at this point. And I would remind everybody that this will be on the World Wide Web within 24 hours or so. So any statements that you would make that you may regret making later, I keep that in mind from a confidentiality standpoint. Okay? And with that, we're ready for the first case.
Judge, may I make a very brief statement? I believe one of the parties, there's a witness, possibly also counsel, whose name is Milo Miller, and I just want to say for the record that we are not, to the best of my knowledge, related.
Very good. Thank you, Judge Miller. Okay, then with that, we're ready to begin.
May it please the court, Jesse Witt for the appellant Hammond Contractors, or Hammond. Co-counsel Seth Fermender is also present. Assuming the court's familiar with the briefs and the underlying facts, we'll proceed directly to argument. The pertinent facts at issue in this appeal are undisputed. There's no dispute that a few days before the trial in this case was set to begin, a mediator relayed a confidential settlement offer from the defendant Louisville to Hammond, offering to settle Hammond's principal damage claim for a certain sum of money. There's no dispute that following some additional discussions off the record between counsel, Hammond's attorney then sent Louisville's attorney an email confirming that Hammond would accept the money that Louisville had offered, provided that Louisville would agree to certain additional terms. There's also no dispute that that email, Hammond's email, explicitly stated that each party would have to pay its own attorney's fees and also abide by other terms that were detailed in a formal settlement agreement and release document that was attached to the email. Finally, there's no dispute that after receiving Hammond's email and attachment, Louisville's attorney called the trial court and represented that the parties had indeed reached a settlement. The only dispute that does exist in this case, the only reason we're all still here, is Louisville's argument that it's not actually bound by the terms set forth in Hammond's email, based on the argument that its attorney had not actually read it when he contacted the trial court. And the fact that this was conceded by Louisville in the trial court, page 2957, paragraph 5 of the record, counsel acknowledged that he had not read the attachments to the email, or apparently not understood them, when he advised the court that there was a settlement. Now, in the briefs, there's a significant amount of discussion concerning which communications were confidential under the Dispute Resolution Act, which were admissible. But what this case ultimately turns on is a straightforward contract analysis under common law, as presented by the Supreme Court in the Akles versus Andrews decision, which of course affirmed Judge Roman's decision from this court.
But on different grounds.
On somewhat different grounds, and I was about to note that, Your Honor, thank you. The Supreme Court's holding was based on slightly different grounds than this court's. And two key points of that holding apply here. First, the Supreme Court expressly said that the Dispute Resolution Act will not preclude the parties from reaching a common law settlement agreement, which differed slightly from this court's decision, which had simply said that the agreement complied. The Supreme Court said that it was really unnecessary to show a signed written mediation communication because the parties had reached an agreement outside and subsequent to mediation. The second point that's crucial about both holdings in Yackel is that when an attorney represents to the trial court that the parties have a settlement, that is binding on his client. And these two events are exactly what happened here. There were negotiations that began with a confidential mediation offer. And the terms of that offer were really irrelevant, although I believe they are in the record, but they really don't matter because that was the confidential starting point for negotiations. Subsequent to that, however, counsel for the parties began negotiating directly, and Hammond's attorney sent its email directly to Louisville's attorney. And when Louisville's attorney received that, he then represented to the trial court that there was indeed a settlement, and the trial was vacated, and the parties did not proceed to trial that Monday. Now, we're of course aware of the argument that Louisville's raised, that it shouldn't be bound by that because its attorney hadn't read the attachment and apparently misunderstood or overlooked the text in the body of the email.
Should not be bound by
the terms of Hammond's email.
Okay.
And they had argued that they hadn't read the attachment, or the attorney argued that he had not read the attachment and apparently did not notice or never really explained what to do with the language in the body of the email that specifically said our final position is detailed in this attachment. In any event, whether it was read or not, Colorado law is clear that a party cannot avoid a contract by claiming that they didn't read it. And for that reason, we believe it is binding on Louisville. And that's supported by the cases cited in the briefs. Also noticed just in reviewing this morning that a similar holding or observation is made in the Poly Trucking case, which I don't believe was addressed in the briefs, but which was cited and discussed in the Summerall case that is also relied upon heavily in the party's briefs.
Excuse me, I guess if I could ask a question.
Please.
You're saying that it is binding because a counsel for Louisville called the court and said the case has been settled?
Correct.
In the course of that phone conversation, he did not describe what the terms were, did he?
That's correct. He indicated the only evidence we have that's admissible is the email from Hammond to Louisville, which Hammond has maintained that when Louisville's attorney represented that the parties had a deal, that's really the only set of terms that could have been enforced.
Well, assuming that you're right, how do you know that that's what he had in mind when he called the judge, that he wasn't referring to the settlement that Louisville is contending as a settlement? How are we to determine that from this rather brief phone call, assuming that the phone call itself is in this?
To address that, I think it raises a couple issues. First, there is interplay with the Dispute Resolution Act, and that basically precludes all of the prior discussions. So, at that point, if Louisville's attorney was not agreeing to the terms in Hammond's email, there's really nothing that could have been enforced, and the trial court, at a minimum, erred by not simply telling the parties to start over.
But I'm focusing on your position that there is a settlement based on the terms set forth in the email that was sent at 1201.
Right. With regard to that, Your Honor, the record simply contradicts that. Louisville has argued in the trial court and here that Hammond's email reflected an acceptance of an earlier offer extended by the mediator and that its telephone call was confirming that. The problem with that is that the record does not show any sort of acceptance by Hammond. It is true that the verb accepts appears in Hammond's email, but the remainder of the email makes very clear that Hammond was modifying the terms of the original offer that the mediator had proposed. Specifically, it was adding provisions that each party would pay its own attorney's fees and requiring that the parties would execute a separate document, which could
be. But the parties are arguing that today.
Yes.
So the question is, how do we know, assuming we can consider the phone call at all, how do we know that Mr. The gentleman who placed the phone call, I'm
getting Mr. Lickie, I believe.
Sorry. How do we know it was in his mind? You may be absolutely, let's assume you're absolutely right that as a legal analysis, now that we're several months after we reviewed all the authorities and everything, let's assume you're right. But how do we know that at the time he didn't think that he was First of all, there's no evidence that he read the email, is there?
There's evidence that he said he did not read it.
All right, so he didn't read the email. So what basis is there for saying that he was accepting the terms of an email that he'd never read? Assuming, again, I'm assuming that you're assuming that the phone call isn't admissible for this purpose.
The basis for that, Your Honor, would be that the case law we cited indicates that the courts apply an objective analysis. They look to whether there's a manifestation of acceptance of the contract under a reasonable standard. The courts do not look at what the subjective state of mind of the party was. So whatever he was thinking when he made that phone call, we would submit is really irrelevant. If his actions manifest an acceptance of Hammond's email, that became binding as a matter of law.
But how can they? If he said he never read the email, I mean, we're accepting that as evidence.
Well, because on that we would direct the court to the cases noting that the party who represents that there's a contract or who signs a contract certainly without reading it is nevertheless bound by it. Essentially, their own negligence in not reading it precludes them from arguing that they were unfamiliar with the terms.
Mr. Witt,
yes.
Along the same lines, how do we know what the offer is that's referred to in the email? We know that there was an offer in an email earlier, but we also know that there was this intervening telephone call. Now, let's assume we can't consider the content of that telephone call. We know that it happened. And the email that follows that refers to the telephone call. So as I read that subsequent email, it could be referring to an offer made in the telephone call, which we have no way of knowing what that is. It could be something different than what was in the email. And what you're asking us to do is pretend that it never happened. Not that we just can't consider the content, but pretend it never happened and cobble together some emails to create an agreement.
Well, I would disagree that we're ignoring the phone call or trying to cobble this together based on the emails. I think as sort of a threshold matter, the panel's correctly identified that there is not very much evidence, and there's Hammond would submit no evidence supporting an acceptance of the mediator's offer, which the trial court enforced. As to the subsequent question of then whether Hammond's terms are controlling or whether the matter should just be sent back to start over, we believe that there is sufficient evidence there, viewed objectively, that the terms in Hammond's email essentially were a counteroffer at that point that was then accepted by the city's actions.
In your view, can we consider the attachments to the 1201 email?
The email from Hammond to Louisville. My view, that's...
I think the trial court did not.
The trial court did not, that's correct.
But it seems to me, I have a difficult time understanding why we can't. If we can consider the text of the email, aren't the attachments part of the email?
Absolutely. And Hammond's position is that you must consider those, in fact. With the email itself expressly references the attachments, trying to, states that I believe it's the documents detail our positions, something to that effect. Trying to interpret the email by itself without the expressly referenced attachments, as the trial court did, we believe you simply can't do. That's like trying to enforce a contract that depends on Exhibit A if you don't have Exhibit A. There's simply nothing there to enforce. So, again, as the first point, certainly Hammond believes that the trial court erred by taking an excerpt from that email and enforcing that as an agreement.
So along those lines, let me back up one step further. What would you say is your position on what's in and what's out in terms of a communication privilege at this point? What can we look at and what can we not look at?
I believe that really the mediator's original offer should not be considered. The trial court did not take evidence on the phone call, and thus that's not in the record, although it probably should have been. And the final written email that was sent from Hammond to Louisville, including all attachments, should be viewed as a complete document and certainly is in the record and again would form the basis of the agreement. In addition, the court may consider the subsequent actions of the party manifesting acceptance, such as the telephone call to the trial court.
You have 2 minutes. Do you want to reserve
time? And I will, with that, let me simply reiterate that the Summerall case I alluded to a moment ago in the briefs that particularly addresses this, dealing with the emails and attachments, and also qualifying language in an email, which there was here. Hammond had indicated that it might change its positions and was basically reserving its right. Under any standard of review, we believe it was error to ignore that qualifying language, to ignore the attachment that was expressly referenced in the email, and find that that was an acceptance of the mediator's prior confidential offer. I'll reserve the remaining time.
Very good. You have 1:39 left.
May it please the court, Robert Lichty for the defendant city. I think that the court needs to put itself into the position of the parties at the time that the settlement supposedly occurred. The city gave an email offer at 6:04 in the morning and said, this offer is only good until noon today. And then at 10, 15 minutes before noon, there was a call from counsel for Hammond saying, we accept the offer. The offer was very, very clear.
Mr. Lichty, before we get into it, you just got into the content of the telephone conversation. In your client's view, what communications can we consider and what can't we consider? Specifically, can we consider the content of that telephone call? Can we consider the attachments to the 1201 email? And can we consider your subsequent phone call to the court?
Yeah, very good point. And it's answered by what is the definition of a mediation communication in the statute. The statute is very specific. It says that a mediation communication is any oral written communication. And then under subsection 307, all mediation communications are privileged, except for a final written agreement which has been fully executed, is not a mediation communication. So it has to be, we know it has to be written, has to be final, has to be executed. Does not have to be signed by the parties. That's only in subsection 308. All it has to be is executed, and that takes it out of, it has to be written in a final agreement which is executed. And that's what the court can look at, because those things are not mediation communications.
So,
but anything else, the telephone calls, that is a mediation communication. It cannot be considered. However, we can consider the writing. It says here, as Mr. Miller just stated to you over the telephone. So we have reference to that. So that can be seen. He accepted your settlement offer. And the settlement offer was very precise. The city stands by the $600,000 as its best offer to settle the fifth claim for relief, the one going to trial next week. The offer remains open until noon on Thursday, 8/7/08. Thursday was that day.
So, but the second part of my question had to do with the attachments. If we look at the attachments, it's pretty clear to me you've got a difference of opinion as to what this offer was. You've got, which is what we're all arguing about here, which is the attorney fees piece. Does it relate to the breach of contract claim, or does it relate to the pending motion relating to the tort claims? And that's a very broad release in that draft settlement agreement.
Right.
And you're saying that goes beyond the offer that you made. So I guess under the law, why isn't that just a counteroffer?
How can you have a counteroffer when it's there? Time is of the essence. They wait until the last minute. And the trial court made these findings. Remember, the trial court made the findings. The trial court referred to the 9 volumes of pleadings. So it wasn't as if this was a really easy case where there was no friction going back and forth. 10 minutes before the deadline, and we had all kinds of witnesses to call. We had the court to call. It wasn't as if we were just going to say, oh, great, it's settled, and do nothing. You know, that afternoon was filled with telephone calls and explanations and making sure that everyone knew what was going on. So time was of the essence. They write, we accept your settlement offer. I mean, how much more clear can you be than that? We accept your offer. It's not that we accept your offer, but they didn't say but. It said we accept your offer.
Now, that is partially detailed below, and here's an attached settlement agreement.
Right.
I mean, you're just taking that one sentence out of context.
It's not. No, I'm putting it in context. The context was we were right up against the limit, right up against the time limit. We had all kinds of things to do. The trial court understood that. The trial court understood that we had not been talking about the torts for a year. we had been involved in the breach of contract action only. But I wanted to make sure that that's the only thing we were settling. That's why I put forth in the offer the fifth claim for relief only. That's the only thing we're settling.
So are you saying we should disregard the words as partially detailed below, that those words have no meaning?
In this context, yes. Because how can you say we accept your offer? We accept your offer, plain and simple. Now, look at the fine print.
They don't say that. They don't say it plain and simple.
They do, too. They say we accept.
From your brief, sir, it says, as Milo Miller just stated to you on the telephone, there's a something,
right.
Heyman accepts the city settlement offer as partially detailed below, and then it goes on and on for another two paragraphs.
What does partially detailed mean?
Shouldn't
it be either fully or not detailed at all?
Sounds like you don't have an agreement.
Well, if they say we accept your offer, and then I look at the attachments, there's all these attachments. Normally, the defendants are the ones who make the releases. I take a look at this stuff. I don't have time for all this. I'm satisfied with the fact that they accepted our offer. And they say here we're not settling out those things that are on the appeal, the matters concerning Kitsman or Carter and Burgess. Of course, how we could affect a Carter and Burgess resolution is beyond me. We're not doing that, but we accept the offer.
Well, Mr. Lucky, the email says, as Milo just stated to you on the telephone, Heyman accepts the city's settlement offer, et cetera.
Yeah.
Now, we know that there was a telephone call.
Yes.
The email refers to it. How do we know, I asked your opposing counsel this, how do we know that the offer referred to in this email at 1201 is the written offer, as you contend, or a different offer that was made during the telephone call, the content of which we cannot consider?
Yeah, you can't consider that content.
But how do we know? How do we know what that word offer refers to?
Because it says we accept the city settlement offer, and we have the settlement offer as part of this chain. Now, the question is...
That begs the question as to what happened in the telephone call, though. The offer could have been changed. We don't know. They contend it was. Now, we can't consider the content of that phone call.
Then if the offer is changed, then it should be put right up front in the email.
Isn't that why they said it's partially detailed below?
I don't know why they use the word partially detailed below. I would think that when you're trying to make a final resolution, you would say we accept your offer as detailed below. And partially detailed below means that there could be something else out there.
Exactly. So how do we get around that?
By determining whether the trial court, who was there in person and who saw the files, who saw all the interaction between the parties, did the trial court have a proper record to make the finding that she did?
So you're saying there's additional things that we should consider beyond the emails?
Gown was in the record before us.
No. Did the trial, so the trial judge said that she read the motions. Now, there was a dispute during the hearing itself as to what could or could not get into evidence. And I was objecting to anything but what would comply with the act. I was objecting to anything else. But the trial court said she looked at the attachments, she looked at all of the exhibits, and as far as she was concerned, Heyman had accepted the city's offer as set forth at 6:04 in the morning, in writing.
Why?
That's what she said.
It sounds like, though, you're asking us to give deference to the trial court when there are no credibility findings here. It's just what do the documents say? Are you asking us to defer?
Well,
to the trial court?
There's a context. There's an overall. I mean, she talked about the 9 volumes of pleadings,
which we can see just as well as the court can. So why should we defer to the trial court?
Because the trial court is the initial fact finder.
But what?
And that's what the Yackel case says.
But here we have documents. There's no dispute as to what they say. Why are we not in as good a position as the trial court to assess the legal effect of those documents?
On the undisputed documents?
Yes. I think they're all undisputed.
Yeah, then you do have a good point.
I Let me ask you about the email chain, just for a moment. When I look back at them, I see that they start at least as early as August 6th, 1124. They're talking about a latest offer. And then there's another one by and through or to Michael Cook, the mediator, that talks about Hammond's counteroffer. And then later on, Mike Cook says, here is Bob's response. Now, I take it some of those are clearly mediation communications. Is
those
that right?
Those would all be mediation communications.
Why wouldn't they all? Why wouldn't all those emails be mediation communications since they came to and through the mediator?
Right. They are all mediation communications except for, and you go back to the definition in 2.5, except for a final written agreement which has been fully executed. And that's why we submitted Exhibit C as
once the mediator was involved and clearly was the middle person in this email exchange, why aren't they all a part of a mediation communication as defined by the statute?
Each one individually is. Any single email is, but if there is an email offer and an email acceptance, those two combined become a final written agreement which has been fully executed.
So to use a word or a phrase that my colleague used, then you would have us cobble out some of the emails then?
Well, you simply, under the statute, you can't look at them because they're privileged communications. The only thing you can look at, again, is the final written agreement which is fully executed. And we submit that Exhibit C is the final written agreement that is fully executed. We submit that the trial court properly found that. Now, the trial court did not make any particular findings regarding the effect of the release. But if you look at the release itself is so vague as to be really not controlling. Well, number one, take a look at the second page of the release, paragraph 10. It says that any dispute under this release goes to judicial arbiter group, doesn't come to court. So Hammond, by its action, said, well, I don't think the release applies, otherwise they would have gone directly to Jack and not filed their motion in the court to enforce the release as the document. The trial court took a look at that, at the release language, said, well, this is all in the context of the contract claim that remains to be tried. Sure, you're going to release the attorney's fees on both sides. We had a pending motion for attorney's fees that was, I think, half a year old at that time. So that was one of the things that was released, and we agreed to that. So when it came to the what the release said, yes, we are releasing all claims for attorney's fees. Now, the way the release was written, provision, it says the city releases Hammond from everything, known and unknown, anytime, no time restriction. So obviously that can't be taken at face value. In other words, if the city has another contract with Hammond and there's a problem, that release doesn't apply to that other contract. Although by the plain terms of the release, it does, because it has no limitation. It said any claims known or unknown. So what the trial court did was it put everything in context and said, we're getting rid of the fifth claim for relief. That's what the offer was. The release is consistent with that. It's consistent with getting rid of all of the claims, counterclaims, et cetera, concerning the fifth claim for relief. And that's what the trial court found.
Can I just ask for a clarification on something you said? Are you saying that the city has released Hammond from the $21,000 attorney's fee issue?
No. No, 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 no.
I didn't say it did. I just wanted to be sure.
No, no, that has not happened.
Okay.
But I submit to the court that the only two alternatives are to affirm the trial court and find that the case was settled for what the city says it was settled for, or simply say there was no agreement on either side and just go back. Either try it or settle it or, you know, start over. Unfortunately, I think those are the only two alternatives that this court has under the Mediation Act. I see my time is almost up. I'll take any other questions if the court has. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, you have a minute and 39 seconds.
Thank you. I'll be brief. First point, I basically ask the record reflect what I believe Judge Miller also heard, which is what I heard, is that at one point Louisville said it was releasing all attorney fees claims. That's not consistent with what it did in the trial court. Beginning at page 3092 in the record.
Well, he's saying that that's not correct.
Well, I didn't think that is correct. I just want to, I guess, clarify then that, immediately after all this happened, page 3092 in the record, Louisville renewed its request for attorney's fees. So clearly, that's the crux of this whole dispute, is that Hammond believed that all claims for attorney's fees had been released. Louisville claimed that it was not bound by any such release. As counsel noted, one option here is certainly to send it back to the trial court enforcing neither party's agreement. Hammond would certainly agree that that would be preferable to enforcing Louisville's version, which has, we believe, no support in the record, although for the arguments I made earlier, we believe that there is grounds to show that Louisville is bound to Hammond's terms. If it's sent back, we would renew our request as set forth in the briefs that the mandate direct the trial court to award post-judgment interest relative to when the parties had these negotiations. None of this $354,000 has been paid. This has all been hung up over a dispute for about 6% of that amount over a small attorney fee claim. And Hammond, as again we argued in the briefs, has been severely damaged by not having access to those funds, or at least even the undisputed portion of those funds, the $320,000 that I think everybody agrees is due. We would ask that post-judgment interest be awarded on that.
Before you leave the podium, Mr. Wood, has there been a ruling in the trial court on that? I know it was briefed to death, but
been a ruling? That was such that it arose for the first time on appeal, in that the trial court never really had an opportunity to rule on that. The reason we raised that as we did is that there is case law from, I believe, this court indicating that a trial court will only have jurisdiction to entertain such a request on remand if it is expressly provided in the mandate. So we would ask, we recognize that this court is not going to calculate interest or do the math on it, but we would ask that the trial court be directed to consider that and make appropriate calculations in the mandate.
Thank you, counsel, and thank you both for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will be issued in due course.